Do 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 do. Do 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 do. Do 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 do. Is anyone out there? My name is Cal Spangler, and I'm a baby boomer, born from a second-generation German-American mother and an American mutt and Pennsylvania Dutch father. His Pennsylvania Dutch relatives came over to Allen Township about 1630. This makes me about three-quarters German heritage. I was fed whole milk and vitamins, and I grew 3 inches taller than my father and exactly a foot taller than my mom. My father's job as district agent for a steamship company required him to be on the road to supervise loading and unloading of ships in the Pacific Northwest ports of Raymond, Aberdeen, Port Angeles, and Port Gamble. He was gone about half the time, and when his ship was here in Seattle, he did not work regular hours. His schedule was driven by how quickly the ship could be loaded or unloaded, and by the tides. Arriving on a flood tide and leaving on an ebb tide saved fuel and time. Then for a week in between ships, he had a more normal life. This left raising Katie, my sister, and I mostly to my mom. And I thought then, as I do now, that I had fairly normal parents and a fairly normal childhood. One of the maybe not so normal things was that in my father's absence, my mother taught me to dance on our wildly ugly linoleum kitchen floor. I kind of enjoyed it. This, however, was not normal. I found this out when we had to dance in grade school. Square dance, folk dance, or whatever. The rest of my boyhood peers did not like to have to hold hands or even touch a girl. I, however, had learned to tolerate, well, enjoy this contact with the opposite sex. I danced through junior high and high school, mostly the twist and variations of what was popular, and slow dancing. I had no style yet, just a slow shuffling of the feet, holding a creature in my arms that smelled good and held me back. Some held me, and some held me back. On to the college scene with a little international folk dancing thrown in. Can you see me performing the hora as an Israeli folk dancer? Fast forward, I started what I call ballroom swing dancing with Susan, my second wife. We took lessons and our style improved, and there must have been some magic. We had a beautiful baby girl, Caitlin. Then between wives, I took more dance lessons, sometimes twice a week, and this should have been a great way to meet women. However, no tall women appeared. And after suffering from an aching back from bending over to hold my usually very much shorter partners, I resolved to find a tall one. Enter me. A raven-haired beauty like my mom. Y'all know I wear my hair on my sleeve. So I talked her into taking a waltz class with me. Our first kiss was Valentine's Day, 1994. And the rest is history. We put our respective homes up for sale, and after settling on an upper limit of affordability, we found our new home in Haller Lake, just down First Avenue, on 128th. It was $50 under budget, but I insisted on paying the full amount, $200,000. Meme's son, Philip, was 9 then, and when we went dancing and went out, we needed someone to stay with him. We found a middle school boy who lived over by the new firehouse. So after a few trips up and down First Avenue, Meme noticed our church sign with an interesting topic for Sunday sermon. We came and stayed, and I found out I was a Unitarian Universalist all my life and never knew it. This is the miracle of coincidence that has brought me to your pulpit today. I am sure there are many more miracles that have brought you here today to listen to me, and this is why I believe in the God of serendipity. Now, 13.7 billion years after the Big Bang, here we are at the top of the evolutionary heap, imperfect as we are. We live on an iron cord planet, just like the ball bearing we're passing around, and mostly covered with water. It's just the right distance from the sun to be not too hot and not too cold. We live in the ultimate Goldilocks zone. So I'm going to start off with a woo-woo factor. In the early days of exploration, sailors needed a way to determine their position east or west, or their longitude. So if you knew what time it was where you were, and you could tell that by the sun, and you knew what time it was in Greenwich, you could subtract the difference and establish your longitude. There were two groups of scientists attacking this problem. There were the horologists, or the clockmakers, and the astronomers. The clockmakers had a problem with a pendulum clock working on a ship, so they had to find another way to do that. Astronomers, on the other hand, had long known that celestial events take place with breathtaking accuracy. And so they set about making tables of events that could be observed, and from that, navigators could determine what time it was at Greenwich, and then compare that to the sun time of their location, and voila, there's your longitude. The fact that these events often took place during the day, and coupled with the difficulty of using a telescope on the rolling deck of a ship, this was a challenging endeavor. The calculations itself in the beginning took 4 hours. But the astronomers persisted, and in 1676, one of them, Danish astronomer Ole Rømer, noted that the time of the transits of the Jovian moons were different from when the Earth was on the near or far side of our orbit from Jupiter. He surmised from this that light, in fact, had a speed, and his estimate for that speed was only slightly off from what we accept today. Today we know the speed of light is about 186,000 miles per second. Here's the crazy part. The Earth is 93 million miles from the sun, so the diameter of the Earth's orbit is 186 million miles. So this means it takes almost exactly 1,000 seconds for light to cross the orbit of Earth. That's an amazing coincidence. As well as its pleasurable warming light, the sun also emits a deadly cosmic radiation, and we are shielded from this by a magnetic field which is generated by the Earth's iron core, which is molten, and the fact that it's rotating. So as long as the core stays molten and the Earth keeps spinning, we're safe. Mars, on the other hand, is also mostly an iron planet, yet it has turned cold and lost its magnetic field. The sun's rays have blasted off its atmosphere, most of its water, and its chance to have life on its surface. There still is hope that we may find some signs of life underground there. Back on Earth, we also have a large moon. Relative to the size of the Earth, we have the largest moon in the solar system. Its position and gravity have protected the Earth from impacts from many meteors. This large moon also gave our oceans powerful lunar tides. This tidal action sloshed the primordial soup from which all life on Earth has sprung. Besides the sun and the moon, consider how perfect our environs are. So we've been passing around the steel ball bearing, and you can feel it's, you know, it's used. So it's not perfectly smooth, but you can feel a little irregularities there. But if we had Mount Everest, for instance, to scale on that ball bearing, it would be about 7/10,000ths of an inch tall, and that's imperceptible to human touch. Likewise, the Marianas Trench, which is the deepest part in the ocean at 7 miles, would also be imperceptible. So how perfect a world do we have? Now, on our 12-inch globe here, Everest would be 8/1,000ths of an inch tall, the thickness of about 2 pages of our order of worship. It would be barely perceptible to human touch. This also is the upper limit of the atmosphere which can support human life. So you could liken the thickness of our atmosphere to the thinnest coating of oil floating on a thin layer of water on this globe. This is where we live. As a matter of scale, the International Space Station orbits at about 175 miles above the Earth. And on this globe, how big would that be? A little under a quarter of an inch. It's pretty close. In comparison to our globe, our moon is about 3.5 inches in diameter and would be about 30 feet away. Strangely enough, this is close to the radius of our dome. Now, Laura, if you went out to First Avenue, we have a slide here. There's our dome. If you went out First Avenue and went north 2.2 miles, we're going to go through. There's the dome. There's the dome. Bigger, bigger. Dome is still here. Oop. Bigger. Let's see. I think there's one more. And you'd find our sun about here, about out to the shoreline pool. And the sun's diameter at that scale would be about 108 feet. Here's another woo-woo factoid. The moon's diameter almost perfectly covers the sun during a solar eclipse. The ratio of the moon's diameter to its distance to the Earth is about 107 to 1. And this is almost exactly the same ratio as the sun's diameter to its distance to the Earth. I find that interesting. One last strange factoid, and that is, why is a lunar day and a lunar year the same? Well, the moon orbits the Earth at exactly the same rate as its rate of rotation. That's why we never see the far side of the moon. The moon is slightly egg-shaped, and its center of gravity is offset from its center. And apparently over the eons, the Earth's gravity has slowed the rotation of the moon, and now the heavy end, the end we see, points toward us. Now, I really can't see any possible connections between these woo-woo factors and why we're here. I just find them amazing. And as you can see, I'm easily amused. Now we have some more numbers. So here's the Space Needle, and we're going to use the Space Needle for a yardstick. Its base, if its base were the Big Bang, and the top being today, each inch of its height would equal about 2 million years. Each millionth of an inch, then, equals 2 years. So the formation, we got to read this from the bottom up. The formation of our solar system would be 200 feet from the top. The earliest life on Earth, 158 feet. The age of dinosaurs between 11 and 2.911 feet. Then the rise of mammals, 26 inches. Lucy, the earliest humanoid, 1.7 inches from the top. Now we're getting up to the light on the top of the Space Needle. And the birth of Jesus, 1/1000th of an inch from the top, essentially a razor blade laying on the top of the Space Needle. Our first radio transmissions would be, and I got to get my places right, 63 millionths of an inch from the top. And the building of the first radio telescopes would be 263 10 millionths. The launch of Voyager, the spacecraft just leaving the heliosphere, would be 189 10 millionths of an inch from the top. So the first radio signals we broadcast in 1890, traveling at the speed of light, they've traveled 721 million miles, only $100 a mile times the national debt. Voyager was launched in 1975 with the mission of exploring the outer planets and then continuing on into deep space. Voyager carries the story of our humanity on an LP record, an 8-track cassette tape, and engraved on a golden plaque. So will the beings who find that spacecraft be able to decipher the drawings, find an 8-track tape player, or a stylist to play that record? If so, they are truly intelligent. At the rate Voyager is traveling, it would take 350,000 years to reach what cosmologists have identified as the nearest habitable planet. So why all these numbers? They're here to illustrate the vastness of time and the immensity of space. One of humanity's big questions is, are we alone? And I believe for another intelligent life form to have evolved exactly at the same time as we have, as highly improbable. They would have had to evolve to a level of technology higher than ours at the same razor-thin period of time that we have. So for time, in time alone, for us to meet them, it would be like having the edges of two razor blades meet perfectly. And now multiply that by the vastness of space, it would be like the points of two needles meeting perfectly, head on. Have there been other intelligent life forms in the past? Are there will be in the future? I find that highly probable. I just don't think we'll meet them. We currently don't have the ability to conquer the vastness of space, and if others are looking for us, how will they find us? Egos aside, we are a mote in the cosmos. We have been broadcasting radio signals for 123 years, and we've been listening for signals from deep space for 50 years. We have had no luck, no sound, no signal, and no response. Science's latest theory is that the universe is still expanding, which means to me, if there's others out there, they're getting farther away from us, not closer. So back to serendipity, and why are we here? Besides our amazing evolutionary journey, can any of us really completely take credit for where we are today? Everyday coincidences coupled with the chance meeting of our pasts, the meeting of our ancestors' past, make for a winding and unpredictable journey, but very interesting. In Dances with Wolves, Lieutenant Dunbar's Indian friend, Kicking Bird, prays to his God, "What surprises do you have for me this day?" I like that. Serendipity has given us these things: the beauty and function of each bird's feather, the fact that bumblebees can fly, that after planting a seed, a new plant will grow that is exactly like its parent, the delight of looking deeply into another human's eyes and seeing their irises expand and contract. These are the blessings of the God of serendipity. How we got here is a miracle, and every day I revel at the wonder of it all. But I'm not going to sit back and tell you to leave it all to serendipity. We have also been blessed with the ability to think and act. I believe that to dream about, to commit to, and to work for our future, the future of our families and our world, is where true human destiny lies. To pray that we have the courage to do these things itself is a lofty goal. So may the God of serendipity not watch over us, but just watch what we do and provide us with more wonder as we go about our lives. So be it.